Who controls the past, controls the future. Who controls the present, controls the past.
The death of bin Laden marks the most significant achievement to date in our nation's effort to defeat al-Qaeda.
All you gotta do is start looking around, start thinking for yourself, start investigating things, and you will see it all right there. So you have the power. Humanity has the power. We have the power. Do you want to fight? You better believe you got one!
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories.
As for me, give me liberty or give me death!
The answer to 1984 is 1776.
Welcome to the InfoWars Nightly News. I'm your host, Jakari Jackson. Here's what we have in store for you on this June 20th, 2013 edition.
Tonight, was it a bomb or just a car accident? An engine ejected down the street and damage done to the car are not consistent with the LAPD story. A look at the suspicious deaths of other high-profile enemies of the state and Michael Cargill on what you need to know to protect yourself and your family. Then, Alex Jones interviews Viggo Mortensen. All that and more on tonight's InfoWars Nightly News.
And welcome back. Top story headline. Evidence indicates Michael Hastings was assassinated. Now, this is something that was talked about on the Alex Jones radio show, and we'll show you those clips in just one moment. But let's go to the article first. For all normal reasons, which account for virtually all car fires in modern cars, the fire would have started when the engine compartment progressed slowly down and scorched the hell out of the paint before ever reaching the gas tank. And keep in mind, the damage done to the car was not consistent with the LAPD story. We'll go on. Whenever I'd been reporting around groups of dudes whose kind of job was to kill people, one of them would usually mention that they were going to kill me, said Hastings. Now, as I alluded to earlier, Alex Jones and David Knight talked about this at great length on the Alex Jones radio show, so here's their in-depth report.
We're going to get into a special report now, the evidence that Michael Hastings was killed. And now the media will go along when they burn down a cabin with somebody in it, when they shoot somebody in the top of the head during questioning at their house. It's not being questioned. And that's when you go into a real tyranny. They'll start killing thousands of people. They'll start arresting people. And at that point, media and journalists have to start taking precautions to protect ourselves. And then if it goes too far, things go on the offense. That's the only way to stop things like this. And they want to start a war. They want to have a secret war against journalists. They've been having one with the whistleblowers, all of it. I mean, if they kill me, folks, you know who did it, and you know what to do. I'm just going to leave it at that. Now, David Knight, you're here with us. One main reason they haven't killed me yet, and they've beat me up and threatened to kill me plenty of times, is they know if they kill us, I have a media organization left behind. That's why you're here, buddy. I've told the crew that privately. You're here, so if they kill me, it continues on. And I want justice. I want reporters there. If they blow me up, they put me in a room with a hooker. You guys work with me. You know I don't do that stuff.
That's right.
They killed me.
Yeah. Right.
They killed me, period. I don't do drugs, none of it. Okay. So bottom line, if this happens, they killed me. This is so obvious. We've got newscasts that are local, but not on the national news, where explosion engine flies down the road. I mean, this is incredible. We're going to get to that. This is a short segment. We're going to have you in the long segment coming up. This is a larger subject, a political assassination. But, I mean, this thing absolutely stinks to high heaven.
You know, last night when I was getting ready to do the nightly news, I started looking at this, and I didn't even get into why this might happen. I mean, didn't even get into the conspiracy theory aspect of it. I'm just looking at this as an accident, and it made absolutely no sense to me. You know, first you hear, oh, it's a fiery crash, high-speed crash. He hits into a tree, and the car catches on fire and burns. That's the way people typically die in a fiery crash. They get pinned in a car that then is somehow compromised mechanically. A fire starts, they can't get out, and they die. That's not what happened here. If you look at the eyewitness report. The only one they've got is a guy named Luis Cortez. And he says he's driving down the road, sees a car coming at him at high speed, and it jackknifes. Now, I don't know exactly what that means, because jackknifing is typically what you're talking about a truck doing, this articulated semi-trailer. But he said jackknife and pieces flew everywhere. And you look at the report.
That's an explosion.
Yeah, it's an explosion. If you look at the report from the people that were there, they said that it was it sounded like a bomb, shook their whole house, rattled their windows. And then another guy points to the engine that he said flew 50 to 60 yards down from the point that it had stopped. And it makes absolutely no sense that an engine is going to fly out of a car at a right angle to the point that it's going when it hits a tree. Then if you look carefully at the pictures, you see that the car is not really crashed. It came to rest up against the tree.
Yeah, it's not even really run into the tree. It's up against it.
Yeah, it's up against it. It's kind of beside it. You can see
the car's exploded. The engine's flown down the road.
And you can see the nose, what's left of the frame of the car, sticking out beyond the tree. So it's kind of like it's beside the tree. After the fire is out, you can see this in this picture from the LA Times. And the nose of the car appears to be sticking out from beyond the tree. The fire seems to be concentrated around the passenger area, but there's absolutely no way that the car is going to veer off to the left or to the right. And
well, I've seen 100 photos of car bombs. That's what they look like.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. There's a tremendous impact there. But the car was not compromised, as you would expect, when it hits a tree. And the fact that the engine flew down the road, and the fact that this one person who saw it said the pieces went everywhere, I mean, that tells you that it blew up while it was going down the road. It did not hit a tree, catch on fire, and then...
We're going to get more into this and get into the statistics, but tell people about this clip.
This is from the Nightly News. So we had this last night. It was a local news story that had this on there, and you'll hear the people, the eyewitnesses' reports on here. Let's take a look at that clip.
Rolling Stone magazine called Michael Hastings a fearless journalist who refused to cozy up to power. His death at 33 came by way of a fire-fueled and explosive crash.
It sounded like a bomb went off in the middle of the night. My house shook. The windows were rattling.
Oh. I couldn't have written a scene like this for a movie where the engine flies from the car, which was about, I don't know, 50, 60 yards up, right down here to this telephone pole.
Unbelievable. And in the national news, it's no foul play, ran into a tree. They blew that car up. Maybe we should say a car crashed into the Oklahoma City building.
Yeah.
Right. A car did.
You know. Well, and when you look at that picture, the car, the engine doesn't look like it's on fire, right?
No, it's been blown out.
It's been blown out. And it looks like it's going back. Part of the transmission there, you see the alternator.
Well, you're an engineer, but you notice it's all aiming back from his trajectory being blown out.
Well, you're not gonna send the engine down the road at a right angle to the point at which it hits a tree, even if it hit the tree. But when you look at the pictures again, you don't see the body being smashed up against a tree. And so when we looked at this last night,
they put the bomb in the dash. You can see it right there. So it blew back towards him and blew the engine out the front.
That's right.
Then the car flipped down the road up against a tree.
That's right. Absolutely.
Seriously, when I talk about people know what to do if they start rounding us up, disappearing us, I have worked as hard as I can to be nonviolent. I have done everything I can. And if they kill me, I don't want people to just go out and randomly, you know, be violent. I want you to aggressively get the word out. Because I'm not afraid to die. I'm afraid of these people running the world. Because once you give into a mafia culture, it just starts taking over and expanding until there's no society and you collapse like all those third world countries. And then the argument is, well, even if you're not a bad person, work with the evil because you'll have a better lot in life. It's the disease of our civilization. And obviously, if they start disappearing people in the night, Alexander Schultz and Eason talked about it, how they burned in the camps later wishing they would have done something. I don't think we've gotten to that point yet, but we need to have a real debate, not just about NSA spying and persecuting the Tea Party with the IRS and persecuting pro-life groups who stand up for little babies. Look how evil these mafia people are. That's all it is we're being muscled. They are killing people. And David Knight covered it last night. A author's come out, you know, with the history, and the New American Magazine wrote about it, about how the Pentagon admits their main tool now is assassination. Well, it's been like that for at least 60, 70 years. I mean, I know a lot of Army officers, Texans, who were in secret assassination groups here in the U.S., and it's not like the people I know are something special, ladies and gentlemen. It's giant. Do you understand that? And they have got, let's be conservative, more than 10,000, I would guesstimate, current domestic assassins that are Army, Navy, you name it. When you become a Navy SEAL or Green Beret or any of this stuff, or even Delta Force, then there's levels above that, okay? And those levels are called the dark side. And it's the narcotics. It's all of it going on. And these are like made men. I don't know if you can tell the story about your Navy SEAL friend. You were just telling me, oh, you don't want to tell it?
No.
But, I mean, these guys, you know, it's just, it's disgusting. It's not cool. It's not tough. And they kill each other, too. I mean, no doubt they did a hit on Chris Kyle. No doubt all this stuff's going on. They will flush you down the toilet in a minute. Remember, hundreds of thousands of Gulf War troops got the Gulf War illness. At least 50,000 have died in the 20 years since. They knew when they detonated those 200-plus chemical dumps that it was all going to rain down and soft kill people. And that's now confirmed for 20 years, the brain stems. It's back in the New York Times last Friday. Again, you do not want to, there's no honor in this. And it's cowardly to blow up this journalist. I know he lied to McChrystal and said it was going to be a puff piece. And in their mafia rules, let me tell you, I would not be let in by the Pentagon or something and lie to them. If I told somebody, I'm not going to expose any of your confidences, because reportedly that's what he did. Because, I mean, it's not just that. I don't tell people I'm going to do something and then not do it. I'll tell the globalists I'm going to try to bring them down. I'll tell them I'm coming for them. In these mafia rules, this is how they operate. I'm telling you, you mess with their families or you work with them and then lie to them, and that's what Hastings did, you're free game. Now, I'm not saying it's good they blew him up, but it's another issue here. If they can burn down somebody in a cabin, say they did it, and then not get in trouble, and they can say that they're going to kill people and blow them up, and people see a bomb go off and kill Pat Tillman and then kill five members of Private Lynch's unit who said that she was cowering in fear. They went out and killed them. And I told Lynch through channels, I said, you better go public and say it was all a lie. They'll kill you next, like Pat Tillman. She went public and said it was all a lie. That's the only reason she's still alive, folks. This is how they operate. You mean nothing to them. Okay? Now, you've got the floor. Break all this down. Go over the history of it, what we're facing, and then that...
Well, Alex, like you were just talking about, the L.A. police, what they said in the case of Chris Dorner, and how they were caught even... You could hear the transcripts, the audio of the police talking to each other saying, burn it down. They still denied that they burned it down. In this particular incident, we've got the L.A. Police Department, same police department, saying the engine's location is evidence that the driver was, quote, hauling Irish ass and lost control, unquote. And with the engine torn off, the gas lines would rupture and it would start a fire. Now, the engine's not going to go flying, no matter how fast you go in a new Mercedes, the engine is, and parts are not going to go flying.
It's
everywhere.
Bolted in.
Right. I mean, this is not some old rusting Hulk with the engine mounts about to come off. This is a new Mercedes. And
look, I flipped a truck doing 80 before and the engine didn't come out.
Right.
Rolled it three times.
Right. And so but they want to say, you know, they've got a couple of different, narratives here. One of them is that it crashes into the tree, catches fire, but then you've got this engine hurled down the road. And they say, oh yeah, well the engine hurled down the road is evidence that's how the fire would have started. But you can't hurl the engine down at a right angle to the point of impact. And if the engine hurls down the road as he's going down the road, it's an explosion.
So you have the witnesses saying, boom, it woke them up, shook their houses.
Right, right. This is a very rare occurrence, too. As we're pointing out, in FEMA, Department of Homeland Security, they were talking about highway vehicle fires, and there's about 250,000 of them a year. Typically nothing happens. Only in about 2% of these do you have a fatality. Actually, the actual number is 2.6%. Out of every...
Can we document cam that, guys?
Sorry, not 2.6%. It's 2.6 out of every 1,000. So it's 0.26.
So I was wrong when I said 2%. It's 0.26.
0.26, yeah. So that's...
So it's less than 1%.
Less than 1%, exactly. Of course, as Darren McBrain pointed out, the probability goes up if you're a journalist that they don't like. Now you were talking.
Oh yeah, they've done those studies on politicians, and not just that they fly more; they do it with other frequent flyers. I saw the statistic like 15 years ago. It's probably changed, either less or more. I don't know. Where you were something like 8 times more likely to die in a plane crash if you were a politician per capita than other frequent flyers that fly the same amount.
That's right. Now, when we covered this on the nightly news last night, we didn't go into speculating as to who might this be. You know, because he's really, you know, ticked off a lot of people, from McChrystal to he was investigating, he had done investigative reports on the CIA, was working on one for the CIA, and as you pointed out, he had tweeted to WikiLeaks that he was being followed by the FBI just hours before he died. So there were a lot of people
in
government, you know, as
just like Cop of the Year Terrence Yakey in Oklahoma City said, I got feds behind me, and they tortured him and killed him.
Mm-hmm.
Last phone call to his partner.
And as you're talking about this assassination government that we've got going on, this book is Mark Mazzetti, he's a Pulitzer Prize winning author. The name of the book is Way of the Knife. And what he's talking about in this is the fact that Obama is using not just the CIA, but he's using the military now for assassination operations that is becoming pervasive. And McChrystal was part of running that. McChrystal was head of the special operations forces there, right? And McChrystal was also involved in the Pat Tillman cover-up. You know, he was the one who was there giving the awards and
oh yeah, he's the main suspect. He strikes again. I forgot McChrystal ran the op and the cover-up of Tillman.
That's right.
So,
you know, you've got this situation where you've got this massive amount of people, not just in the CIA, but now in special operations in the military, and you've got another author who has written an entire book about how assassination, and it's not just drone assassination, that's something that we look at and we say, wow, that's really cold. That's amazing that they're just raining death down on people from the air. That's just more visible. The invisible things that they're doing with all of these special operation forces and with the CIA, that, as you said, has been going on for a long time.
But they've just expanded it.
They've expanded it, and they don't even try to cover it up much anymore. And you get these ridiculous statements from the LA Police Department with situations like Chris Dorner, and again now with this car accident, it just doesn't make any
sense. Well, you know, the LA system was the beta test. Daryl Gates, before he died, mm-hmm. gave interviews that the CIA in the 60s came in as a beta test, put them in black uniforms, militarize them, make it sexy, esprit de corps, all the other cops will want to be federalized.
So started the SWAT teams is in LA?
SWAT teams, all of it. They started in LA, then in New York and Dallas of all places, and then Houston, taking special ops hitmen and putting them into police departments mm-hmm. so that when they need to kill a CIA guy, like they did down in Houston a few years ago, they pull him over, the CIA section guy gets out, what, Carney was his name, and they shoot him right in the head under the helicopter. The guy's hands are at his side, boom, execution. And then he tracked back that cop, he was in black ops. Mm-hmm. So every major department has these federal hitmen on it now. Man, and they're not even feds, they work for foreign banks. I mean, this country's just in so much trouble.
And what's amazing about it is, like you said, you can get a video of it, you can get audio recordings of it, you can look at where the engine is, where the car is, the condition of the car, none of the
witnesses
stuff
saying it blew up.
Yeah. And it's
because I've seen cars crash outside my house, run into a tree, people been hurt, killed. Everybody's seen it. You hear, it's a big noise.
Yes.
But it doesn't shake your house. Only the explosive wave by high explosive sends that.
Mm-hmm. That's right. But even if it had been an explosion because of gas lines, the engine was ejected down the road. The engine is not on
fire. Gasoline doesn't send those explosive waves, though.
Right. You talk about a smoking gun. I mean, there's no smoking engine. You know, that car was just really engulfed in flames, but the engine is down the road, not touched. So, I mean, that.
And the witnesses are saying it's driving down the road. I saw one where it's driving and bursts into flames.
Yeah, that's what the witness says. He says, I was just coming northbound on Highland and I saw a car going really fast. All of a sudden, I seen it jackknife. I just seen parts fly everywhere and I slammed on my brakes and stopped and tried to call 911. That's Luis Cortez. That's the eyewitness report, the only eyewitness report, because this happened at 4:30 in the morning.
Now, statistically, it being L.A., it was probably the police that loaded the bomb. I mean, that's usually, it's kind of like a turf deal, and they get their payment, and that's how it works.
Well, I tell you what, I mean, the L.A. Police Department, especially after the Dornan case, they just don't, they don't have any credibility.
They're the Gambinos.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Look, I have had dinner with retired detectives and people that are basically with the Vikings. You know, they made movies about that. It's real. And they're just like, of course 9/11's an inside job. Of course they blew it up. I mean, they're like, what do you do? Everything's a mafia. I've been to a bunch of parties with them. I know some are famous cops. I mean, it's like, of course. It's all a big joke. I don't think this is cute. I don't want my kids growing up in a country like this.
No, no. And it is really frightening that they can just do this out in the open and deny it, and no matter how ridiculous it is. Another story that broke yesterday was the TWA Flight 800. a new documentary coming out where they've got six investigators who were shut down by the FBI when this happens.
They arrested journalists. We needed to get them on, who snuck in and got the samples in the hangar. It was an explosive, continuous rod warhead.
That's right. And in that case, you see the FBI is going out and interviewing people and just not putting down an official transcript, putting down a summary, not showing the summary even to the witnesses to say, did we get it right? I mean, they just went through a perfunctory.
There were 700 Army and Navy witnesses to the missile.
Yeah.
They were having a drill then.
Yeah, exactly. And you got transcriptions of airline pilots.
Of course, you know, the plane was loaded with Egyptian military officers.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I got to show you this.
The Rise of the Killer Drones, How America Goes to War in Secret. Michael Hastings, an inside look at how killing by remote control has changed the way of flight. Yeah, these are the articles.
And here's a drone strike from above. See, the wheels are still intact? Gigi Urnetta just pointed that out. Is it possible this guy could have been hit by a drone as sort of a, you're writing about drones?
Yeah.
Now we're going to hit you.
Yeah.
McChrystal's out there.
Yeah, that drone strike does look like that. But generally, I know it looks similar, but that would hammer the engine down or maybe out. Depends on where the missile hit.
Right.
I mean, it's much easier and easier to hide. Why would they go with something exotic? Or maybe they'll start having drones out in public and kill people. I mean, it's really a flaunting now of these psychopaths. It could be, but seeing other car bombs, the professionals put plastic explosives and a lot of times with an accelerant and with something that's flammable to burn up the evidence, it looks like a dashboard bomb to me.
Right. Yeah, because that was a very intense fire. Like, that looks even more intense than that would have been.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that car was completely engulfed.
Well, fragmentation.
Yeah. I mean, Gigi Urnetta brought that to my attention, and I'm like, we got to go. You guys are talking about this right now, and it's just so, he's writing about drones.
Yeah.
And
I don't know, that drone strike, you know? I mean, that does.
Yeah.
That's a drone. Yeah. Let me show people on document cam that are watching on TV. Go ahead.
And also, I sent the guys a link. McChrystal was on that billboard a while back that we covered, and it was when Colin Powell and a bunch of those guys came here to speak. Rudy Giuliani was the other guy. And somebody put up their Pat Tillman and the numbers on it. It was pretty crazy. They put a star on the guy's forehead. I don't know. It was pretty, and I just thought that was interesting.
Some bad person climbed up on there and did that here in Austin?
I know.
Wonder who that was.
I can't believe it. But
that was disrespectful.
I just think that, you know, people already know the truth about this guy, and people have known it for years, you know, and he's still walking around scot-free at that point, mm-hmm. you know.
How dare someone climb up on the billboard and do that?
I hate when people do that.
We should just let these people kill everybody.
Yeah, exactly.
No, we should all be scared of them too.
You know, this Hastings thing is going to get a lot deeper, definitely.
Well, I don't even think they care now. I mean, maybe they did, but I'm surprised they didn't have a drone fly over in broad daylight and announce, we're now going to blow it up, kind of like Dorner. We're going to burn it down. All right, bring the fire, burn it down.
Yeah, well, and the guy said it suddenly jackknifed. I mean, that could be from a bomb or it could be from a drone strike. You know, how do these things happen?
Actually, when they hit one, they do kind of fly up and do that. Wow, it depends on what kind of missile they used.
I mean, are they that brazen at this point?
If it was a bomb from underneath that had enough forcing it to sever the engine and send it down 150 feet down the road, I mean, it would go up, lift up in the air.
Yeah, that sounds like 8-10 pounds of plastic.
Yeah.
I don't know. But it's not a situation where it did not crash into the tree.
No.
Pin him in there and then catch fire. That is not what happened.
But that's what the news is going to say.
Right. Here's the deal. If my car blows up, they killed me, okay?
Right.
All right, good job, dude.
All right.
We'll be covering this more.
Well, one other thing from McChrystal is, you may remember he was also a big proponent of the universal service. You know, so in spite of his criticisms of Obama that were reported by Michael Hastings that caused him to get fired, he really loves Obama's programs, right? He loves national service and he hates citizens having weapons. You know, he made the rounds of all the talk shows.
He's an anti-gunner. He's a real authoritarian.
Oh yeah. And he was talking about,
better not talk too bad about him. I'll end up like Pat Tillman.
So why do you want to have military weapons? And what he would talk about would be the velocity of the bullet. He wasn't talking about the fact that Homeland Security is getting hollow point bullets, which are far more destructive to people. You know, but he was talking about, oh, these military bullets, they travel this speed, you don't need that. And it's like, the speed of the bullet doesn't
matter. But these guys are such gangsters, illegally spying on us, and Alexander, the head of the NSA, says, hey, I'm going to meet with the FBI director, and I'll owe him a frickin' beer. I mean, it's all there's just such a bunch of goons.
Yeah, yeah. But
they will destroy this country if they're able to.
Yeah. It's just amazing to me, as I said, when I look at this, how the media is just falling in lockstep with this official narrative. And you can see the pictures even that the media puts there that contradict what they're saying. And they still go along with this.
Well, that's always the evidence, is they're immediately, no foul play, ran into a tree.
Yeah.
And then witnesses all say the opposite.
Yeah. Yeah.
And again, he tells WikiLeaks, I'm being followed by the FBI. I gotta get this out quick. I mean, to be like, the government's following me. Oh, my car blows up. It's like, oh, nothing to see here. Go on to sleep. Well, and I mean, will the media stand up, you prostitutes of the globalist, shelling out your families, even as they kill you?
There's a great report from Alex and David, so definitely go to PrisonPlanet.tv and watch that whole thing, the whole breakdown, so you can see it for yourself again and again, and send that to your friends and family. Now, you may be a new viewer, or maybe, you know, you just haven't heard too many of these incidences like what happened to Hastings. These are not isolated incidents. You know, that may have been the first time I've ever heard of an engine like flying down the street or so forth. That's not a NASCAR race, but this isn't anything new. So we're going to break down for you just a small sampling, about 10 or so incidences of people who mysteriously committed suicide and so forth under very fishy circumstances. We'll go now to this first one, a recent one, FBI killing of man with ties to Tsarnaev, self-defense or excessive force. We'll skip down to after, was there a knife? According to the preliminary FBI account, Tolchev became violent and lunged at the FBI special agent with a knife while being questioned about his ties to the alleged Boston bombing bomber, Tamerlan Tsarnaev. The target reacted to the imminent threat and shot Tolchev dead. Later, the FBI backed away from that version of events. And then they were like, well, did the guy have a knife? Did he did not have a knife? And the guy was like, well, you know, we just started shooting, and when we finished, he was dead. And that's pretty much what happened to that guy, a very unfortunate circumstance. You know, just like the younger brother having his throat slit just out of nowhere. I'm not exactly sure how that happened. We'll move on to our next one. Kate Middleton hospital nurse dies in suspected suicide after being duped by a radio show. Now, this was a situation, maybe you guys remember it, maybe you don't. A radio show called and had a prank call, and they said, oh, I'm the King of England, and oh, we just want to check on Kate, and, you know, whatever. That's a horrible accent. Their accent was probably worse than mine. And they basically duped this woman into putting them through to the room that Kate was in. And a couple days later, she was pronounced dead not too far from the hospital. And the reports are saying that she killed herself. Another very fishy situation. I don't know why you would just up and kill yourself, but, you know, it makes sense to some people. We'll move on to this. Autopsy rules handcuffed man shot himself in the back of a police car. Now, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to laugh. This is a very serious situation. It's just the headline is just so ridiculous. It's accurate, but it's very ridiculous. A handcuffed man that had been searched twice, shot himself in the head in the back of a squad car. And we'll skip down a little bit. It says, police say Carter's handcuffs were double locked behind his back, and he was frisked twice before being placed in the squad car. But somehow he managed to pull out his .380 caliber Cobra semi-automatic firearm and shot himself in the back of the head. And once again, this is not a famous person or somebody had something to do with a famous incident, but this is just the type of tie-ins and cover-ups that can go on. I'm not saying this guy is innocent of any particular thing, but to shoot himself in the back of the head while handcuffed after being frisked twice, that sounds more than a little fishy to me. We'll move on to this. Aaron Swartz was killed by the government. Father tells mourners. Now, this is the father, of course, of Mr. Swartz. And he said he was killed by the government and MIT betrayed all of their basic principles. Facing the possibility of a long prison sentence if convicted of charges that he illegally downloaded millions of academic journal articles, Swartz hanged himself in his New York apartment Friday. Now, this is the reposting of an article. I definitely don't believe that. And keep in mind, Swartz was the type of guy that he didn't run from a fight. He was facing, you know, a lengthy prison sentence. He was offered a plea deal of 3 months and said no to that. So why you would turn down a plea sentence of 3 months and then go and kill yourself, I don't exactly understand. 3 months isn't all that. I mean, I wouldn't want to be locked up for one day for something I didn't do. But, you know, 3 months versus, you know, 30 plus years isn't that big bad of a deal. Now we're going to move on to Terrence Yankee. Now you can see right there at the top of the page, you may be familiar with him from A Noble Liar, a video we sell in the InfoWars shop. Mr. Yankee, well, I just want to read. Let's scroll down a little bit and we'll go on here. On May 11, 1996, the New York Times ran a story with the headline, "A policeman who rescued four in bombing kills himself." Now, just in case you don't know, Mr. Yankee, he was a first responder during the Oklahoma City bombing. He rushed in, he saved, and like I said, four people or so. And then some things started happening. Maybe he saw a couple things that he wasn't supposed to see. And the article goes on to detail his very graphic and brutal, quote, suicide. I don't believe that for one second, but the suicide, if we can go back to the article. He said he was said to have slit his wrist, his neck, causing him to nearly bleed to death in his car, and then miraculously climbed a barbed wire fence, and then he was purported to have walked over a mile in distance through a nearby field and eventually shot himself through a very unusual angle. So, keep in mind, this is a man who allegedly slit his wrist, slit his throat, went out, hiked a mile or so, hopped a barbed wire fence, and then just decided this is a good place to die and shot himself in the head. And that's what the official story is. And if you say that makes absolutely no sense, I don't think I could walk across the street if I slit my wrist. If nothing else, just for the sheer panic of it, yeah, I would agree with you. But according to the official story, that's what happens to these whistleblowers and people who just happen to see more than what they were supposed to see. We'll move on now to DC Madam predicted she would be suicided. Now, this is somebody who was a regular guest on the Alex Jones radio show. Let's go down to the second paragraph. "If taken into custody, my physical safety and most probably my life would be jeopardized." And she said this in 1991. She said, "Rape, beating, maiming, disfigurement, and more likely murder disguised in the form of just another jailhouse incident or suicide await me." And we'll scroll down a little bit more. Fraley had threatened to release the names of well-known clients to our upscale call girl ring, including those of one Dick Cheney. So when you mess around with these big, powerful guys, people like Cheney, I'm not, maybe I shouldn't call Cheney big and powerful, these infamous guys, death could be easily a coming for you. And I remember hearing Alex Jones talk about this, not just him, but other people as well. We'll move on to this. "Only eyewitness to Breitbart's death disappears." Now, this article details not only the death of Andrew Breitbart, but also his coroner. And I believe that's in the first sentence up there. It says, "Following the suspected arsenic poisoning of his forensic technician." So there's another guy. But let's go down to the second paragraph. 26-year-old Christopher Lassiter saw Breitbart drop dead like a sack of potatoes on March 1st. Hours before Breitbart was set to release a damning video that showed Barack Obama fraternizing with the Weather Underground terrorist Bill Ayers. And if I remember correctly, Bill Ayers is now calling Obama the terrorist. So that's a very strange turn of events. But there you go, Mr. Breitbart dropped dead, just like the article says. He had some very very infamous footage of Obama, photographs and so forth, saying that he was affiliated with various groups, and he just ends up dropping dead like a sack of potatoes. And also his coroner died, and I believe it was reported at the time, it was just hours after he died, they said, oh, we know the exact cause of death, just hours after he died. But keep in mind, when you have situations like a Whitney Houston or Michael Jackson, situations like that, they're very calm and collected, and it takes a while for the actual cause of death to come out. But you have a situation with Breitbart where, you know, he's barely cold, and oh, we know it happened exactly like this. That's a very fishy telltale sign, and also how the coroner just up and dropped dead. Now, we're coming to the end of our segment here, but let's go to this one. Coroner Gary Webb's death confirmed as a suicide. We'll scroll down a little bit. New York. The death of investigative reporter Gary Webb has confirmed as a suicide, according to a coroner's statement. The cause of death was determined to be a self-inflicted gunshot wound, wounds to the head. And that's a statement issued by the Sacramento County Coroner's Office. Let's pause right there. To shoot yourself in the head with a semi-automatic firearm once is a great accomplishment. But to do that twice is just so beyond me how you could do this. And I'll go back to the article. And it's just baffling. I'm out of all these suicides and alleged suicide, I should say, it just really gets to me how anybody can believe that a man shot himself twice in the head with a semi-automatic firearm. And then have people believe it, or if you dare question Mr. Webb's suicide, then you're a kook, you're crazy. And of course, Webb gained national attention in the 1990s when he was writing a series of articles in the Mercury News linking the CIA to Contras and so forth. So there you go, guy shooting himself in the head twice, people slitting their wrists and throats and then going jogging for a mile. Who else? People shooting themselves while handcuffed, people hanging themselves after they said, no, I'll fight you to the death. That's the new normal. And now we have Mr. Hastings to add to that list. A gentleman who was driving in his car, regardless if he is driving fast or not, allegedly struck a tree and his car burst into flames. I'm waiting for that statement from Mercedes claiming that their vehicles don't spontaneously combust. I'm definitely sure that will drive down their ownership if they can't get to the bottom of that one. So let's look at those pictures, and you can see it right there. That thing fell into a burning ring of fire. That thing is lit up. You got shrapnel and so forth. Let's scroll down a little bit. Okay, so we're taking a look at this, and for whatever reason, they have the front end covered up, but the back end looks pretty banged up to me. Now, I'm not a master physicist and so forth, but I'm wondering why the back end is so beat up if it hit a tree. That doesn't really make a whole lot of sense to me. And the reports say that the vehicle allegedly jackknifed. People heard what they believed to be an explosion. And as David Knight pointed out in that report earlier, jackknifing is usually for trucks and big, heavy vehicles, not your smaller Mercedes types. So it's a very curious situation. I'm just looking at that picture right there. Very curious why the back end is so beat up. And also, Mercedes, if you want to sell another car, you might want to tell people that your cars don't spontaneously combust, even if they run into trees at high speeds or whatever. It's very unusual. Just think about a NASCAR race. How many of those cars, you know, they may spark, they may, you know, shoot out a few little sparklets, but they don't just bust into flames very rarely, I'm pretty sure. But that's what they're saying happened to this vehicle. Makes absolutely no sense at all. Now we'll move on to the final segment of our show. We're going to move on to this. Microsoft changes its mind on Xbox One's used games and always on policies. Now, if you remember, they were once saying that the Xbox had to be always on, permanently connected to the internet, and we'll look at some of these bullet points here. And it said it once had to be plugged in 24 hours a day just to play, and they said, we'll get rid of that. And they also said they would have certain regional restrictions, we'll get rid of that. Users and so forth, we'll get rid of that. And also people made a big deal about how they wouldn't be able to play and trade games. And they said, okay, well, the people have spoken, so we'll just scrap this whole shebang, but they do require you to at least hook your Xbox up to the internet once. I guess when you first buy it, you have to go and log in your username and passcode or what after that. But after that, you can use it free as you see fit. And it's people out crying, because I remember it was a week ago or 2 weeks ago, a guy was at a video game conference. He said, well, if you don't like the Xbox One being permanently connected to the internet, you can go buy an Xbox 360. And well, people say, well, I already have an Xbox 360, so I just won't buy an Xbox One. Then they go, oh, well, okay, we'll just say you don't have to connect your thing to the internet anymore. And power of the people. You speak out, they listen, and if they don't listen to anything else, they'll listen to the bottom dollar. And I don't know what happened to that guy who made that real goofy, snotty statement, but I'm pretty sure he won't be making any press conferences anytime soon. Now, we had some fun with this last article. We had some very important issues going through the alleged suicides and so forth earlier, but I want to go to this. This is a very serious topic. Oregon State Police taser autistic child found wandering naked. Now, this is a situation. I just want to read this this quote right here. The girl's father also took issue to KDRV's reportage, which frequently referred to the girl as a young woman, a woman, and a juvenile. Now, this is a 11-year-old girl who was found wandering naked down the highway. A gentleman, I believe he was a taxi driver, pulled up beside her and said, hey, are you okay? Are you lost? Are you like, what's going on here? And the girl doesn't listen to him. She just keeps walking down the street. She turns out to be autistic and has communication issues. The gentleman, cab driver, calls the police. The police come up. And just like you see there, they tase the girl and then put her on the hood of a car like she's in some type of drug buster. They thought she was running guns or something. And, that's the taxi driver right there giving his testimony. And you can go to Infowars.com and see that video for yourself. But we actually have the girl's father who's going to be joining us. His name is Aram. He's very emotional and rightly so. You know, this guy has every right to be outraged. This is a horrible situation because we see the situations where they taser people for noncompliance, tase people who have seizures, and tase people who don't want to stand up or sit down or whatever the drill may be at the time, and then they just tase this person and think they did the right thing. So we're going to have him. He joins us right now via Skype. All right, thanks for joining us, Aaron.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I know this is a very difficult time, and you got a lot of emotions, and I understand you've been talking to some other news agencies, so definitely want you at your best. You just let it fly. Tell us what happened. You receive, I'm guessing, a phone call telling you this has happened to your daughter.
Yeah, well, what happened is, obviously, it was the middle of the night. We were sleeping. The phone was ringing at 6:30 in the morning, and we got a call saying that we have your daughter down at the Rogue Valley Medical Center here in Southern Oregon. And we're like, what in the world? And so we run in the room. We're like, it's got to be a mistake. And sure enough, she's not there. So we're like, holy crap, you know. She has escaped before, but never in this manner. It's typical of autistic kids, or certain autistic kids, to boogie. You know, they just like to get out and go for an adventure. And once they put their line of sight down a direction, they just keep going. So we're like, holy crap. So we go down there, and once we get her, we find out that the state police, in the process of apprehending her, had to tase her 2 times.
Oh, my God. Now, let's just talk about the tasering, okay? So your daughter, she's walking down the street. I saw the video with the cab driver, I believe it was. He was the witness of the thing. He says your daughter's walking down the street. She's not, you know, hindering anybody. No, of course, it's a very unsafe situation for anybody to be, not just a child. But so the police approach your daughter. They issue 2 verbal commands, if I'm correct, and then fire on her with a taser. Is that correct, sir?
That is correct. But also, I mean, she was in a non-threatening manner. She was giggling. She wasn't
she wasn't aggressive.
She wasn't aggressive. She wasn't in some agitated state. She was giggling. And I mean, I can picture, I know my daughter, she was probably running down the road thinking it was the best thing in the world, you know. Mm-hmm. She was probably, the cab driver said she was giggling, and that's just typical. She just thinks this is really cool. So when the state police pull up, rather than approach the situation in trying to apprehend her, you know, physically, and it's obvious she has no weapons. It's obvious she's not a threat. They give her 2 verbal commands. And then tase her. And then once they tased her, she obviously got excited. Right. And then they had to tase her again.
Is she on the ground? Does she go down with the first taser?
She went down. And then they tried to apprehend her. But once, you know, the taser comes out, she got scared. And a lot of autistic kids have a lot of strength. Mm. They have kind of an abnormal amount of strength, especially when you're excited. When you get hit with a taser, your adrenaline starts pumping. You know, prior to that, she was giggling. But then they had to physically apprehend her. They had to get other help. They did the normal, you know, like they're apprehending a dangerous criminal.
Right.
They slammed her head on the hood of the car, handcuffed her, threw her in the back of the police car when she would have gone voluntarily. I know my daughter, she loves cars. Anybody drives up to her, if she's walking along, she just hops right in the car because she loves cars. That's one of her characteristics, you know, of her particular view of
just whatever. Her characteristic. Now, I want to ask you, because you have I'm pretty sure you can get a lot of people talking negatively about you and your family saying, well, what was this girl doing outside at this hour anyway, especially with no clothes on? How did this situation come about?
Well, it's not the first time. It's not the first time. She is very well known with the local police and emergency services, and also with the community. Everyone knows her. They know her characteristics, so it wasn't within the community. And also, she is involved in state custody with the DHS or CPS.
Mm-hmm.
For more of on a services level rather than them trying to take her, which they do want to do. They want to put her in an institution eventually, I'm pretty sure.
Have they told you this before, that they want to take her, or is that your observation?
No, that's their intent eventually, I'm sure. And that was their intent a long time ago, but we provided a safe environment for her, and We've had her all her life. She's never actually been in a foster home or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But there has been various foster homes kind of salivating at getting a hold of her because they can get a lot of money for having them
of course,
in their care because she's an extra special needs child, and they can get a lot of money if she goes in one of those foster homes.
Exactly. Now let's talk about her condition at the time. So she's out walking around and she happens to be nude. Is this something unusual for your daughter?
No, not at all. Not at all. No, that's absolutely normal. I know it sounds strange to a lot of people, but she has a sensory thing about her skin. She takes her clothes off all the time. And that's one of the problems with her being in an institution is that,
well, that would be a real problem if she was taken to an institution, a juvenile center, lo and behold, a jail. So they're going to have this person who doesn't want to keep their clothes on, and that's going to be a real problem.
It's going to be a real problem because most of these institutions that they keep these kids in are also, you got to worry about the staff, you got to worry about the other, the other clients. It's a real problem. She's a lot better off at home than in an institution. I can guarantee you that, and a lot safer, mm-hmm. even though these things might happen. But they're still going to have the same problems in an institution unless they lock her down completely and basically imprison her. Mm-hmm. So some people's argument is, well, it's better to imprison her and save her life than let her have a life with her family and, have some risks. There's going to be risks with a child like this wherever they are. Mm-hmm. It's a struggle. We had an emergency meeting about it with the state, and the state has actually been pretty supportive. I'm not sure if it's because they don't know where to place her and right. they don't have funding, or if it's because they're genuinely concerned. I'm hoping that it's there. Over time, there has been a community of people like her teachers and a community of people that have really kind of surrounded her and supported us. Yeah, and supported us against the state, because I've had experience with the state on this level of DHS. It's here in Oregon, but it's basically CPS.
Oh, yeah.
That's kept her safe is a lot of that community support and outrage, because this has happened before.
To this extent where police were involved with tasers and so forth.
Yeah, not in the middle of the night and not naked.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, is your daughter at home with you right now? Is she back safe and sound? Is she in custody? Where is she at this moment?
She's at grandma's right now.
Okay, so she's at least in your custody. She's not of the state right now.
Okay. No, she's in our custody. Yeah.
Okay. Now, I want to ask you, sir, this is obviously something that's very near and dear to your heart, something that you are very emotional about. Let's say, lo and behold, one of these incidents happens to happen again. What do you think would happen? Even if it's not on this level that the police were involved, you're saying that, they're itching to take your child away. Do you think they may try to take your child away?
Well, I think one of the problems, I think they would have done so if she wasn't such a unique case and they could find a place to put her. But I think eventually there are various institutions, and they have been expressed to us, that want her. And there are a few different facilities that, like I said, are kind of salivating to get a kid like this because they can get so many resources for this job. And once they get her, of course, they're going to drug her up and basically imprison her.
Oh, yeah.
And get a lot of federal receipts and state receipts for having her. So to other parties, she's a kind of a gold mine, until for the rest of her life, basically.
Right.
And facilities do not have the same patience and understanding that a family member has when she has an outburst. Mm-hmm. She is very strong. She does trapeze. She's very physically fit. And she does have outbursts where she'll scratch you or anything like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So then her physical safety becomes an issue. Even though she's a child and she may lash out, then she has to deal with a adult supervisor. And I know your time is short, and also this is very emotional for you, so we're going to wrap this thing up. And also, I believe we're going to have you on the Alex Jones radio show pretty soon, but I just want to ask you this question. What do you think about the local news coverage? Could I watch the clip where they were interviewing the cab driver, and they kept referring to your daughter as a young woman or a juvenile? Your daughter is 11 years old, is that correct?
Yeah, she's 11 years old, and that wasn't the first time. We'd already complained about it in the when we read the first emergency services article in the paper, where they referred to her as a late teen and a woman. And we called up and said, look, this is not a woman. This is a, not only an 11-year-old kid, but a handicapped kid at that.
Right.
And they followed up with a news segment where they still called her a woman. Mm-hmm. Now, the last time I checked, an 11-year-old kid is not a woman, especially one that is handicapped.
Right.
Handicapped. So it seems to me like they want to call her a woman to somehow kind of create an atmosphere where it's okay to tase an 11-year-old kid.
An 11-year-old is not a child. It's not even a teen. And they have the audacity to call her a young woman, a woman, I guess in some reports put it, a juvenile, so forth, but she's an 11-year-old little girl. She's a little girl.
She's a little girl, and mentally, she's even littler. You know, she's not a woman by any stretch of the imagination.
Exactly. Now, I know your time is short. Can you just give us your closing thoughts?
Well, I think that police training has really gotten to this level where they don't really care about who they're interacting with. They just react. In whatever's the most convenient, easiest way to deal with whatever they're dealing with. And if that means tasing or shooting them with a gun, then that's just how they react. And police never are concerned with dealing with people as people. They look at everybody as a potential criminal that might hurt them, so it's better to shoot them first rather than kind of be diplomatic and deal with the situation. It's just oh, here's someone that's naked running down the road, tase. And if that didn't work, you know, what, would they have shot her? Isn't the taser the primary barrier between shooting? So what's next? You know, that didn't work. Police tactics really need to get some additional training on dealing with handicapped kids, because there are thousands and thousands of kids, just like my daughter across this country right now.
Right.
Autism is an epidemic.
Let me. I know I said that's the last question, but let me ask you this. Because you'll get a lot of critics out there and say, well, they tased her, but he would have thrown a fit had the cops come up and maybe grabbed her or put their hands on her. How do you think the situation should have been resolved?
She ain't like that. I mean, she's not afraid of strangers. She doesn't care about if you're a stranger or whatever. You can walk up, grab her hand, and get her in the car. No problem.
So you would have been perfectly fine if the officer, you know, even if she was non-compliant verbally, which you say she has difficulties in that area, but the officer came, took her by the hand, maybe even gently nudged her by the shoulder, said, hey, get into this police car. Would you be fine with that scenario?
Well, absolutely. I'm happy that she's home safe, even though she was tased. I'm just happy that she's home safe. So it's kind of a mixed emotional thing. It's like, okay, well, if you had to tase her to save her life, okay, fine. I'm just glad she's home and she's safe, and I'm appreciative that the police were there. I mean, when you need the police and they're there, it's a wonderful thing. But some of their tactics and training really need some work. It's mixed emotions.
Right. Well, I got you, and I definitely appreciate your time and look forward to seeing you on the Alex Jones Radio Show very soon.
All right. Thanks, Shikari.
All right, thank you, Aaron. And there he goes. And like I said, he will be joining us on the Alex Jones Radio Show very soon, so be sure to tune in for that. Now, we're going to go to a clip. This is a clip a caller called in. He said, hey, have you guys seen this? This is Senator Rockefeller at a roast of Pat Buchanan saying, hey, you need to join the New World Order.
You know, I think Pat's coming quickly. Soon, I think he's going to be in a position for the Trilateral Commission. And if he shows promise beyond that, there's Bilderberg. World control, Pat. Settle for nothing else.
People are laughing at these very unfunny jokes. I had to laugh because nothing he said was funny, not even like being dead serious. He just wasn't funny. I guess they had the big telescreens, applause, laugh, or whatever it said. And I'm very curious, I believe we're to the point now where the mainstream media admits that there is a Bilderberg. This guy was joking about it back in 1991, not just that, but the Trilateral Commission, which I hope people accept the Trilateral Commission of actually existing. But this man was making jokes about it back in 1991, but it never existed until, you know, BBC decided to make fun of Alex Jones for covering it. But that's the media coverage we're dealing with. Now, we're going out to our quote of the day. This is a very good quote. John Bound found this. It's really pretty good. Let's take a look. This is from Michael Hastings. The simple and terrifying reality forbidden from discussion in America. was that despite spending $600 billion a year on the military, despite having the best fighting force in the world has ever known, they were getting their asses kicked by illiterate peasants who made bombs out of manure and wood, that by Michael Hastings. And he makes a very good point here, because people think about AK-47s, AR-15, small arms, as they're called, and they say, well, you can't defend yourself from a foreign government or maybe even a local government using these things. Let's say Russia decided, hey, we just want to come in and storm Florida for whatever reason. They say the people in Florida can't defend themselves with AK-47s and AR-15s, because what if the Russians have drones, or they have tanks, or they have this, or they have that? Think about people in Afghanistan, people in Iraq who are using old busted up AK-47s that lo and behold still work, but they're able to fight off this threat using these, you know, outdated weapons. Because it's not so much the weapon, it's the holder and also the intent of the person. Because you think about a occupying army, this is their GI Bill. This is how they're going to send their kids to school, or, you know, right to retirement fund or whatever else. When you go and occupy somebody's country, you're living in their backyard. So when you build this big giant base, like, hey man, my goat should be out there grazing across the field over there that you just built your big thing on, and then you shot my uncle last week because he was wearing the wrong kind of thing on his head. Now people get mad about this kind of stuff, and they have a will to fight, and it works well, great for the people in Afghanistan and all these other places. The Syrian rebels, which I don't support one bit, but you see these guys out there being effective with their AK-47, so those things obviously work and are able to keep people at bay. But yet, I digress. We have reached the end of the show, or at least the end of the news portion of the show. And keep in mind, Operation Paul Revere is still going on. Well, the submissions are over. Let me be clear about that. But we're still in the judging process. So be encouraged. I believe they're going to announce it, actually, the winners at the end of July. So stay tuned for that. We'll be doing updates and having more people on the show to talk about their great films and what motivated them to make them. So stay tuned for that. But the end of July, I believe, is the actual announcement for Operation Paul Revere. And also, that's a good thing, you can go to Paul Revere at Infowars.com and send us your favorite video. And we're requesting that you only send one video per email. You can send multiple emails if you choose, but we do ask you to narrow it down to at least your top two or three and just say, hey, I think this was best. And not just tell us what you think was best, but tell us why. I like this guy's cinematography, or I like the message, or I liked the actors, or whatever it may be. Just send us your email and let us know, and we'll take that all in consideration. Now, if you want to support this operation, go to PrisonPlanet.tv and get yourself a 15-day free trial. You can get it all right there, the Alex Jones Show, the rants, and so much more right there. Now, stick around, because after this, we're going to have two very powerful interviews, one with Mike Cargill that I'm going to do, and also Alex Jones's interview with Viggo Mortensen. That's right, the guy from The Lord of the Rings, the king in The Lord of the Rings. He called into the Alex Jones radio show today, so we're going to have that whole interview as well as Mike Cargill right after this.
Now you can watch Alex Jones live at Infowars.com/show.
You'll find links to all of our content there and a free 15-day trial for Prison Planet TV.
You can also browse the network, the Infowars Nightly News,
and over 60 movies and documentaries all together in one place.
You can watch the Alex Jones Radio Show live as it happens.
So check it out, Infowars.com/show.
Are we choosing our own paths, our own destiny, or has it been pre-selected for us?
C.S. Lewis said, when training beats education, civilization dies.
We need to always be cognizant of, as a free society, that information can be used as a weapon.
Barrier to discovery is not ignorance. It's the illusion of knowledge.
We are seen as nothing but biological androids.
To gain control of education in America, not for a philanthropic purpose, but to change the thinking of the American people.
From the time we're very young, we're taught to, you know, worship authority, basically, because that's our key to survival as young children.
Discover the history, the present, and the future of mind control. From compulsory state education to the Hollywood media brainwashing machine, we are kept in perpetual bondage to the ideas that shape our actions.
And the CIA, scientists could actually film people who had been surreptitiously dosed with LSD.
There's a brain entrainment process that takes place.
That gives the government free rein to create whatever story or narrative it wants to create.
Whatever the public face of something is, whatever they're talking about publicly, There's something else over here they're probably not looking at.
How to engineer the opinion of the American people so that they would fully endorse, not only endorse, but demand a war.
When you watch mainline establishment television, you are putting yourself in front of the barrel of a gun. Discover the history, the present, and the future of mind control, psychological warfare, brainwashing. Are we controlled and manipulated? You bet.
That's mind control par excellence.
Find out how deep the rabbit hole really goes with this new groundbreaking documentary film, State of Mind. Available exclusively at InfoWars.com.
The important thing about the Pro One filter today is that the material we use for removing fluoride and other heavy metals now will remove the latest form of fluoride called hydrofluorosilicic acid. There's no other fluoride reduction filter out there that will remove that type of fluoride. And it's extremely important because today we're hearing more and more cities are using that form of fluoride.
We've been having medication forced on us through the water system for quite a while. Most people don't realize it. Most people don't realize the negative effects of fluoride.
There's a wide range of health effects that are attributed to fluoride.
Bottom line, why should somebody get this new Pro One ProPure filter?
The reason to buy the Pro One, it's an all-in-one filter. It's convenient, easy to use. It doesn't require the add-on fluoride filter. And in addition, this filter removes the latest form of fluoride called hydrofluorosilicic acid.
All right, and welcome back. This is going to be a double interview, I guess a triple interview. We had the interview earlier with the father of the 11-year-old who was tased. But right now it's going to be time for the king from Lord of the Rings, Viggo Mortensen, called into the Alex Jones radio show this morning, and this is what he had to say.
We are joined by someone who's actually on set, and we appreciate him taking time off to come on for some humanitarian purposes in a film that he's promoting, dealing with just unbelievable horse slaughter. But he's also dealing with a lot of other social issues, and that's Viggo of course, Lord of the Rings, Viggo Mortensen, of so many huge films. I am a giant fan. My wife is a huge fan. Everybody I know is a huge fan, and he joins us. Where do you join us from, sir?
Hi, I'm back in California, first time in many months. I'm actually at a photo lab. I'm working on I have a publishing company too, and I'm fine-tuning some images for a new publication of ours.
Yeah, I knew that you'd just been on a plane recently and then we're doing some shoots. Well, it's great to have you with us. Thank you. Thank you for coming on. There's so much to talk about. I know that you just were given the Dennis Hopper Award at the AMFM Festival.
Mm. Yeah, that was a big honor, and it was a lot of fun. The AMFM inaugural festival down in Cathedral City by Palm Springs. It was a good event. A lot of really interesting artists and thoughtful people, and people know how to have a good time too. It was probably the most unpretentious film festival or award ceremony I've ever been to. I think it has a great future. I think it's real artists are gonna go more and more to that festival, I think.
Well, I appreciate you coming on the broadcast to talk about independent festivals, independent film, music. I know you're a huge supporter of that. What is your view on the growth of independent culture?
Well, it's always been there, and it's always going to be there. It's just how much attention it gets. You know, when people don't hear about it very much, they think it's dead, or they think, artists have sold out or something. But there's people making, you know, original art all the time, interacting with each other. The great thing about something like the AMFM Festival down there is that it wasn't just about movies. It was about photographers and painters, sculptors, writers. And there were these gatherings where people would be on stage or in different venues talking about their artwork and getting a lot of ideas from other people working in different in a different medium that can inspire you a lot. I mean, I'm someone who I think that the reason that they that they honored me was not just because I was a friend of Dennis Hopper's and had worked with him in a couple of movies, but because we had a life, you know, a long friendship where we shared a lot of ideas about painting and art and worked together on that, not just acting. And, you know, Dennis was always curious. Even towards the end of his life, he would always want to go see a new artist show or a new independent movie. He was curious, you know, and curiosity is something that we all have as kids. It's something that either gets beaten out of you or you somehow become ashamed or are led to be ashamed of the way you draw or your ideas or dressing up or playing make-believe and all that sort of stuff. And I think the function that artists have is to keep people childlike in a positive way, you know, to keep open to the world. And I think that apart from traveling to different countries or different communities, different parts of your city, I think that art is the one of the greatest anti-war and anti-poverty weapons there are. When your eyes are open and you see how other people live and how other people think and create, it's a lot less likely that you're going to be convinced by your army captain or your president or your politician that it's a good idea to go bomb this or that country. It's a good idea to forget about this or that community or this group of people in your own country. I just think that that's something that kids play together. They don't look at what color the other kid is. They don't judge the other kid's drawing, you know. They say, oh, you drew that? Let me draw this. Oh, let me show you what you could add to that drawing. Or, you know, look at this thing I found. What do you think of this, you know? And comparing in a positive way, I think that's something that kids naturally do. When we get older, you know, I can speak for myself as an artist or as an actor even. You know, the make-believe kids when they're playing, when they're 5, 6, 7 years old, and they believe that they're cowboys or princesses or Robin Hood or, you know, Lakota Chiefs or whatever they're doing, or Superman or Iron Man, you don't have to direct them. You don't have to say, let's do another take because I didn't really believe that you were convinced yourself.
It's that joy of discovery.
But as actors, when you're adult, you do need a director once in a while to say, I didn't believe that. Did you believe that? Well, you can do better. Come on. And it's because we get stiff, just like our muscles get stiff. You have to exercise your creative muscles, just like you have to exercise
Wow.
your body.
Well, Viggo Mortensen, international superstar, joins us. You know, I know a few people out in Hollywood, and they've all told me you are the most down-to-earth, cool person they know. You speak, 6, 7 languages? You're a writer, painter, musician. I've seen some of the amazing YouTube interviews you've done, and there's so much I want to ask you in the limited time. I want to get into the sequel, Rise of the Renegades, dealing with the insanity of what's happening with Wild Horses with you. But shifting gears, the NSA, what do you make of the fact that just a few years ago people would say, oh, it's a conspiracy theory that they're listening to us, and now we learn they're targeting political dissidents. Aaron Swartz was being harassed. We're learning that they're using the IRS against political groups. Do you think there's an awakening happening, or do you think that now the system just doesn't care if we know that we're slaves, basically, Viggo?
I think that there is an awakening because all these things are being talked about right now, today. But, you know, people have very short attention spans nowadays. You know, the more gadgets we have, the more phones and apps. And I mean, it started with the onslaught of cable TV way back when, and then the Internet. And the more access we have, you would think the more informed we're going to be and the more connected we're going to be with each other. But people tend to go to the information that supports what they already believe.
Yes.
You know? And so people seem to get more disunited rather than more united, unfortunately. And when I say short attention span, yeah, the whole stuff about the NSA or about, you know, the IRS, about the drone strikes. I mean, how much are they talking about drone strikes right now? Not really at all, but like another fad that just went away in a news cycle. And I think the problem is, and I think the politicians count on this, is that people can be, you know, swayed. Like, here's a piece of cheese, follow this piece of cheese, and go over there and pay attention to that for a while I take care of this other business. The problem with Obama, and I support a lot of things about him, I think he's a very intelligent man, I supported him more times. It wasn't really much of another option, obviously. But the thing is that the people that he appointed, right, to start to begin with in 2008, people he announced that were going to be part of fixing the, you know, economic disaster that Bush left, were the same people that had caused the problem on Wall Street, for example. So I didn't expect much there. His behavior in foreign policy, whether it be Iraq, Guantanamo, Afghanistan, you know, people still think that Afghanistan is a good war. It's not any more of a good war than Iraq was. It's not any more of a sensible use of our resources and our, you know, young people's lives. And the, you know, the murder, not to mention the
sure, well, what about Obama getting a peace prize and then now putting Al-Qaeda in Syria?
That's ridiculous. I mean, unfortunately, Obama's government has not really been much different than Bush's in a lot of areas, and not just in foreign policy. Foreign policy is the most egregious, you know. Like, if we go into Syria now to try to help get rid of Assad, people in the Arab world aren't going to say, oh, isn't that great? The U.S. is doing something good. Because the way they have seen the United States, the way they judge the United States is based on how they behave in the Israel-Palestine situation, the way they have behaved since 1948. And every single president, including Obama, has given special treatment to Israel. And that's obvious to Arab people. So it's going to be hard for us to be considered the good guy, which is something that our government and I think our people, we all want people to like us and think, oh, we're the good guys. We're the guys from World War II that handed out candy bars on the streets of Paris and Rome. You know, we're the guys with the Marshall Plan. People don't see us that way, unfortunately. They see us as the bullies. It's not these Americans that are any nicer or less nice than other people in the world. We're just people. But our government, which represents us,
absolutely,
has not been a good player. Very rarely has been a good player overseas.
Viggo Mortensen is our guest. Going back to the NSA here, Peter King, Dick Cheney, others have called for his arrest. There's been news in the Daily Mail where they're talking about killing him. I think that Snowden is a hero leaking the NSA info. Viggo Mortensen, what would you like to say on that subject?
I think he's definitely a very brave person. I also think it's ironic that all the Bush team, you know, attack Obama and friends to Obama for doing exactly the same thing they were doing. You know, I mean, it's pretty hypocritical that behavior. I know this seems like, you know, a small thing, but it starts locally. You know, activism and,
oh, I agree,
and common sense community activity. I have to say something about additionally about the AMFM festival.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
Which is that the mayor of Cathedral City, Kathleen DeRosa, she did something very clever, or the government down there, or city council, whatever. They allowed a lot of buildings, and, you know, would be, as a consequence of what happened in 2008 with the economy and with real estate all over the country, there was a lot of retail space that had been built that, you know, businesses just left there, and there's all these empty space and a lot of communities. And what they did in Cathedral City is that they donated or gave very low rent to people who wanted to open galleries and art spaces. And those spaces down there are being used in a really good way, and it's not just that it's nice to look at or it's good to take the kids to see artwork.
Well, that's what made New York the head of culture worldwide, was in the 30s, them doing that.
Exactly, and that proactive stance from the local government down in Cathedral City has not just made life richer for people, but it's also improved the economy. There's people opening, you know, places to eat. There's a lot of activity down there, rather than just being another urban wasteland, you know.
Well, that's what's great about what you do, Viggo, is you're so down to earth and you use your mind. You're obviously a really smart guy and also your celebrity to all over the world. You just go around actually trying to help people instead of just going to a photo op and doing it. And it's so exciting. Speaking of a new film, Rise of the Renegades, a sequel to Wild Horses and Renegades, you know, these beautiful horses out there. And I saw in write-ups of the film, I want to see it, and you're out there obviously promoting it, trying to bring attention to this, that they gave the horses to a guy who was going to take care of them and get them homes, who was a known horse meat guy. It's just ridiculous how transparent the government is. Your take on that?
Well, it's a long story, and we probably don't have time for it, but I do recommend you see this movie by James Kleiner. The Bureau of Land Management and, you know, government in Washington in general has not had a very good history with wild horses and burros. And, you know, it's a lot of attention is being brought to the subject by this film, but also by a lot of other activists. Netta DiMaio is a woman who is tireless, probably has done more than anyone else on the subject. And it's connected to a lot of other things. You know, one of the reasons that they want to get rid of these horses, or what happened during the Bush years when Cheney was in charge of that, was handing out free passes to corporations, whether it was legal or not, to go into protected areas where these horses are to extract resources, and building roads when you weren't allowed to build roads. And the judicial system was so clogged up with all these violations that these people knew that they could go in there and wreak havoc on our public land, which belonged to all Americans, and that it would take years for them to be processed, and they could extract the resources, groom the place, and move on, and probably later settle out of court or something. No, it's a big problem. There's a lot of issues involved. It's not just about protecting wild horses, which is a great thing in itself.
So folks need to see the film. We're going to...
I encourage people to see the film, and just put Google, put wild horses or wild horses preservation. You know, do a little homework, you know. That's the great thing about the Internet. If you use it wisely, you can learn a lot of things. I mean, I learn things every day from it. But, you know, as far as the news, the things that you talk about on your program all the time, you know, your listeners will often, I'm sure, be surprised that, really, that's what's going on? And then they'll go look it up. When I say that people tend to go to what they already know, it's what they do. You know, you go look at the news about your sports team, not other sports.
Well, Vigo, my broadcast...
You'll listen to CNN or to Fox, or you'll listen to watch MSNBC or whatever. You'll listen to your show only.
Vigo, you were offered the part of Zod and didn't take it?
I wasn't available at the time. Unfortunately, it probably would have been a lot of fun to play that part, although I have a lot of respect for Terrence Stamp's portrayal, I got to say.
Oh, yeah, I saw him in The Iceman, chilling. He's an incredible actor.
Mm, he's very good. Yeah, you can't do everything, you know. You just try to follow your instincts, and you know, my philosophy is prepare the best you can for accidents to happen, because they always will, and something good can come out of an obstacle always.
Who knows? Absolutely. But I would love to see you play a villain. I mean, I've seen you play, like, mobsters trying to be reformed and things. Have I missed a film where you're a villain?
I played Lucifer once in a movie called The Prophecy.
That's right. I saw that.
With Chris Walken.
Yeah, that's a good movie.
You never know. I mean, I just try to follow my nose, you know. If I like a story, I'll go do it. I don't really think about the budget or where it's being shot or anything. And, you know, fortunately, since I can speak more than one language, I've been able to work the last couple of years. I did two really interesting movies down in Argentina, one that came out recently here called Everyone Has a Plan, where I played twin brothers who don't like each other very much. That was an interesting kind of thriller. And, you know, I'm going to go do a movie that's set in a very interesting... Have you ever seen a movie called Battle of Algiers by Pontecorvo?
I love that movie. It's almost like a documentary. You're watching it and you think it's real.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. It's set during the fight for independence in Algeria from France, which has been a colonial occupier for 130 years. And imagine if the United States had been in Iraq for 130 years straight. That's how set up, but people were there. But it was a complicated subject. Anyway, there's a movie that's being shot that takes place during that period, late 50s, in North Africa this fall. I'm back in that one. And but I got to bone up a little because I have to speak French.
I can't wait to see that.
Well, I hope it gets over here. The problem is those little movies have a hard time getting distributed over here. But, you know, I figure if you do your best and you do a good job, eventually it'll get seen somewhere.
Well, we're seeing a resurgence of art house films because of more of the smaller theaters. I just love it. Moving quickly, because I know you've got to go, Bob Anderson, the greatest swordmaster ever who died last year, said you were the greatest swordsman he ever trained, and I think he said not just in movies. I mean, how good are you with a sword, Vigo?
Well, I'm probably a little rusty now, but that's high praise coming from Bob Anderson. He's a legend in swordmaster circles. He was something else. He's been in movies. He was in the Olympics. That's how he started out as he was a fencing champion and a great person. He was an incredible teacher. Very strict sometimes, but he had a good sense of humor, and he was tough, but he was fair, and I learned a lot from him. He's the one who taught me to do all the fighting for Lord of the Rings. That's where I met him, and then I subsequently did a period movie, a big Spanish epic, 17th century, where we fought with two blades, you know, with rapier and dagger, and that was
so bottom line, don't get in a knife fight with Viggo Mortensen. I want to give out the name of your publishing company, where you also publish a lot of photos, articles, videos, things you're doing. I've been to the site before, so many great things on there. It's percivalpress.com, and we'll email that out at The Real Alex Jones on Twitter. Going back to what you said right before the break, and then I've got one other question, and I'll let you get out of here, Vigo. You're a real sweetheart to come on with us, your busy schedule. You were talking about getting outside the box. Google admits they now, and YouTube tries to keep you in what they think you like, and they admit to balkanize the population, and I agree with you. The greatest solution...
How do they do that?
They take what your surfing history already is, and they admit, then if you're searching or on YouTube or anything they own, then they try to keep you on a digital plantation of only what you're already into.
Yeah, it's true that you have to push yourself. You know, I mean, it's the same as getting off the couch and at least going for a walk, you know. It's not always the first thing you want to do. You'd maybe rather stay on the couch and eat another bag of chips, but it's good for you to get out and go for a run or go for a walk or go talk to somebody, you know, get off the phone, get away from the TV and so forth once in a while or regularly. And it's the same with looking for, if you're curious about what's going on in your community and what's going on in the world, you got to make an extra effort. You know, go listen to people and read people that you know you probably won't agree with, just to get the other side of it. Make up your own mind, because the left, the right, all journalists, all commentators have their spin, have their motivation.
Get out of the rut. Get out of the rut.
Yeah,
expand.
Yeah, make up your own mind, but you got to make an effort. It's not just going to be handed to you by a computer without you making an effort to go look elsewhere. You know?
Wow, Vigo, amazing. In closing, most horror movies, I'm not a horror fan. I like science fiction that has some, you know, violence in it or whatever, just because that makes it more real. But since I was a child, no movies have scared me. And I've seen movies before that are, you know, were action adventure, and I'll want to watch them again. The Road touched me like no other film I've ever seen. And because I've studied history and things and had some experiences, it's so real. And I know within 10 days, most people become cannibals in Pentagon studies. In closing, that's a film that I am physically afraid to watch again because of almost the ancestral fears that it rises. And what if there's a nuclear war? What if our atmosphere? What if The Road? What can you say about that?
Well, it's true. It's a harrowing experience to watch it, but it's also beautifully made. And John Hillcoat directed that movie, and John did a great job with a tough subject matter. And the boy in it, Cody Smigmathie, who's now he's over 6 feet tall. He's a man now, but he was fantastic in that movie. And it's unfortunate that at the last minute they decided comment on that movie as they do any other movie. It really touched the nerve. And it's kind of, like you say, it's a good warning in a way. Like, if we don't want to end up that way, you got to take an action.
Well, the most touching part is, in closing, is when Robert Duvall, you and your son are there, and he explains that boy's a god in this ugly, destroyed world. He doesn't say that, but that's what I got in the poetry of it, yeah. Is that this youth, this energy, the creativity, the green shoots in a dead world, if children are our future. And, I mean, what did you take away by that writing?
Yeah, beautiful. I mean, I would paraphrase in a way what he was saying, or how I would put it is children are God. Pay attention. That doesn't mean spoil your kid, or it doesn't mean you're talking specifically about the kid, but remember what you felt when you were a kid. Remember your creative instincts. Remember your instincts for peace. Remember your instincts for fellowship and for making something beautiful out of life, not destroying the world and not destroying the lives of others, you know, as adults often do, unfortunately. So remember, kid, remember yourself as a kid, and you're going to be on the right track.
Well, Viggo Mortensen, you are a beautiful person, and I hope to meet you someday in person. God bless you for sharing your time with us and for trying to help humanity. You're an example to us all, and I look forward to speaking to you again.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Viggo. Wow, that was a powerful interview. That is really amazing, and it's amazing to know that we've touched Viggo, you know, that he listens to the show, and it's just another example of, you know, how many amazing people there are out there that know what's happening. I'm telling you, ladies and gentlemen, I've read too many accounts of war and collapsed society, seeing something like The Road. That movie is it's like Godfather 1, where it's like it's real, or the Battle for Algiers he mentioned. You watch that, and you think it's a documentary. It's done so good. And there's parts of Godfather where it's not magic like that. The Road is magic from the start to the end, and Viggo is an artist.
A great interview right there. It's very encouraging to see people awake, and not only awake, but willing to stand on their principles, because we hear that there are many people who are allegedly awake and interested in these type of issues, but they don't want to talk about it for political reasons, or they think it's going to impact their next film. But this guy comes out and he says, hey, I'm awake, and I want everybody to know about this, as many of my fans as possible. So definitely appreciate you, Mr. Mortensen, taking time to be with us, and we'll look forward to you being back on the show in the future. Now stay tuned right after this break, because I'll be talking to Mike Cargill.
Now you can watch the InfoWars Nightly News streaming live, as it happens, for free.
Check it out at InfoWars.com/show.
Many anthropologists and archaeologists believe that before man even discovered the power to harness and use fire, we were involved in agrarian activities. That is, taking the seeds of plants and then replanting them to produce more. The very foundation of our modern civilization and human culture is centered around the planting and cultivation of edible plants, fruits, vegetables, nuts, you name it. And the globalists have been going after gardening. They've been harassing people that have gardens in their front yards or their backyards. They've called for licenses for people to have gardens, because you can't trust prisoners in the police state America to be able to grow their own food. That's why I've come to the realization that we need to become self-sufficient. You need to be informed. You need to have the Second Amendment to protect yourself. You need to be politically active to wake up others. You need to filter your water. But you also need to plant a garden. Even if you live in an apartment, you can do this. If you live in the countryside, obviously you can do it on a grand scale. There are so many green belts in areas that humans don't even visit, nearby cities and in suburbs, where people are now more and more planting their own little private gardens and meadows and off the side of the road. Ladies and gentlemen, it is a revolutionary act to unplug from the television, to unplug from the computer and all the globalist propaganda, and to go out in your backyard or your front yard or planters at your apartment or on the roof of the building where you live, and to plant a garden.
Here are some of the amazing deals at InfoWars Seed Center at InfoWarsShop.com. The Survival Seed Vault by My Patriot Supply features only the finest survival heirloom seeds for a robust and hardy garden, even in the toughest of times. The ARC All-in-One Seed Kit contains 70 varieties of 50,000 seeds of fruits, vegetables, medicinal, and culinary herbs. All ARC seeds are heirloom. Each type is labeled and sealed separately for ease of use and longevity. The Deluxe Emergency Seed Bank combines three of Emergency Seed Bank's top sellers: the Family Survival Emergency Seed Bank, the Medicinal Herb Seeds Pack, and the Culinary Herb Seeds Pack. We also have starter varieties of the deluxe seed packages for fruit, salad, salsa, peppers, and medicinal herbs and more. Go to the InfoWars Seed Center at InfoWarsShop.com.
A little seed can grow a huge tree that produces fruit for up to 50 years. We have the best life bombs. That's what these are. We have the best weapons against death out there at the lowest prices, waiting for you to lovingly plant them and lovingly grow them and lovingly eat them and share them with others. We will strike back against the New World Order, and this is only one more initiative in our fight against them. So please join us at InfoWarsShop.com, or you can link through at InfoWars.com at the InfoWars Seed Center.
And welcome back. Our guest tonight is Michael Cargill of Central Texas Gunworks. If you were watching the Alex Jones radio show today, you heard him right after Viggo Mortensen. Alex was pretty excited about both those interviews, but Michael is here. He is a Second Amendment advocate, a leader in his community. He's going to talk to us about all things Second Amendment. Thanks for joining us, Michael.
Thank you for having me.
All right, now, there's a lot of stuff, but, you know, I told you this off the record, you know, off camera, that the reason we have you in studio it's because Alex is watching one of your debates last week, a town hall debate, and Alex was like, we need to get that guy on the show. I was like, Alex, man, I talk to that guy like every 2 weeks. He's at every event I go to. Alex was like, well, I haven't talked to him yet. So that's what brought you here in the studio. Just tell us a little bit about that debate.
Awesome. Yes, we had a debate in Georgetown, and it was a town hall meeting setting in the courthouse. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to focus on gun control in America. And basically, you know, they invited, you know, members of the Brady campaign and some other individuals in a community to, you know, discuss gun control and about taking Americans' gun rights away from them.
Right, that's pretty much what it was. And I'm sitting here and I'm looking at it, and they have one, you know, you have a whole panel of people up there, but there's one lady in particular that struck my interest. She was somebody from the crowd. Lady comes up and she says, hey, you know, I was raped and I wish I had a gun. And, you know, they field the questions back to the panelists, and nobody really had a good explanation as to why this woman doesn't need a gun, or why she needs a gun and maybe has only 7 bullets, or, you know, whatever the rhetoric may be.
Right. You have some people that have that mindset of just like the Virginia Tech shooting, that when the shooter came into the one room and fired a few shots and then left that room, went to a different room, one guy that was laying on the floor grabbed the only weapon he could, which was his cell phone,
right,
and dialed 911. And being on the phone 20 minutes with the 911 operator, you know, the shooter then came back into the room again, end up shooting him in the rear. Mm. And then a young lady next to him grabbed his phone, and the shooter went out again. And then she's on the phone with 911. And then the shooter comes back into the room and continues shooting.
Right.
You know, and they will tell you that in a situation like that, they still believe that anyone with a concealed handgun license would not have been able to help them.
And that's the whole thing. Like, well, what if you missed? Okay, what if I scared the guy away?
Right.
You know, and that was one of the things. I think that's the last time I actually saw you was at the rally at the Capitol, and that was one of the very things that you were marching for was carry on campus. Tell us about that.
Right. I'm a big supporter of concealed carry on campus because back when I was in the military, I got a phone call by way of the Red Cross that said that I had a family emergency. I need to come home. So I went home to find out that my grandmother decided that at 70 years old, she was going to travel back to college to get a college degree. My grandmother only got a high school education, so at 70, she wanted to become a nurse. Well, while she was traveling from a college library, sitting at a bus stop waiting for a bus to come, mm-hmm. a guy came along, mugged her, and raped her.
Wow,
At the bus stop. And I decided at that point that I would make sure that every female in my family had the tools they needed to protect themselves. It's not about, you know, being able to carry a police officer on your back or your shoulders. Mm-hmm. It's not about me helping women out. It's about empowering them to protect themselves and not needing a man to do that for them.
And that's exactly what we see, because when we talk to these people at the town halls and we talk them at the, you know, the debates, the marches, wherever they may be, and they're, you know, for stricter gun control, they say, well, you know, if you have a problem, call the police. You know, and the thing is, 2 minutes. Okay, let's say the cops do get you at 2 minutes. How much damage can be done in 2 minutes? I don't want to wait for the police officer to get there, as well-intentioned as he may be, as well-armed as he may be. That's not helping me right now in this moment.
Right. We had a shooting in at University of Texas back in September 2010. Mm-hmm. Guy with AK-47 came onto the campus, shot a couple rounds in the air, went into the library, went upstairs, shot and killed himself. Mm-hmm. Do you know who the first police department was that arrived on the scene?
Who was that?
It was APD, not UTPD. The first police officer that arrived on the scene, you know how long it took him to get there after the first shots were fired?
How long was that?
It was 20 minutes. Your longest shootouts take place in 12 minutes. Your longest shootouts take place in 30 seconds. Mm-hmm. So 12 minutes to get there. The first police officer that arrived in the scene did not go into the building right away. You want to know why?
Why?
Because the shooter had an AK-47, and he was a motorcycle cop with a handgun.
Mm-hmm.
And he was waiting for backup to arrive, more firepower. See, I don't want to be that person that's waiting for police to come and save me. I want to have the tools I need to protect myself and to protect my family.
And you brought up a very good point there, because the police get here, now the police are here, and I'm not mad at the cop, you know, he was outgunned, you know, whatever the situation may have been, but now you have to wait for, you know, more backup to arrive, possibly a SWAT team. How long does it take a SWAT team to get together to get out there on the road?
Correct. And people will tell you that, well, what if the police officer arrive at the scene and see the CHO holder with the gun? They're going to, mistake that person as a shooter. No, that's not going to happen like that. That CHO holder, when he gets that person in sight, will deploy that firearm,
mm-hmm.
stop that individual, reholster that firearm, and then start giving first aid to the other people that have been shot.
Exactly.
By the time the paramedics get there, that person will need first aid from giving first aid.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. People who have a CHL, responsible gun handlers, you know, they're not going to run around like a John Wayne movie waving their gun in the air. They're going to wait until the moment, if that should ever occur, pull out, draw down, fire, and then reholster. You made a very good point. But you also brought up another point that a lot of people will criticize. Well, the guy in this particular situation had an AK-47. Why does this guy need an AK-47? Nobody should have an AK-47. What would you say to somebody like that?
Well, no one needs a Mercedes. No one needs a BMW, but we all want them. So we can afford to buy them. So, don't tell me what I cannot have. This is the United States of America, and that's why it's called the land of the free, land of the brave.
Right. All right, now there's a lot of topics I want to talk about with you. We had an article about you earlier this year back in January. Texas gun shop owner calls for Groupon boycott after deal is nixed. Tell us about that.
Oh, yeah. We did a deal with Groupon, and we did a concealed handgun license class for two people. And so the deal went live, and after one day of the deal going live, my Groupon rep gave me a call, and they said, "Man, Mike, your deal is going great. You know, it's looking like it's going to sell out. You know, can we increase the amount of people that can purchase the deal?"
Mm-hmm.
I told them, "Sure. So go ahead and let's, double it or triple it. You know, whatever you want to do, I'll go ahead and sign, the contract or send you an email, and we'll make it happen."
Right.
Because we do everything in writing. They said, "Great." So they went forth and do great things. That next morning, I came into work. He called me up. He said, "Well, Mike, the CEO of Groupon has decided to suspend all gun deals, anything related to gun ranges, shooting clays,
shooting classes, groups,
right,
anything,
yeah. Anything dealing with guns, they're going to cancel those deals." And I said, "Why? You know, the deal's going great." "Well, because of the incident in Connecticut and what's going on."
Now we have to stop everything gun related.
So now we're going to focus on certain tools. It's okay, to have a deal where you go to a porn studio or something like that, but mm-hmm. it's not okay to have, the gun deal where people are actually learning safety and learning the laws.
Yeah, it's such a knee-jerk reaction because there is an incident. Just like the recent incident with this reporter on Rolling Stone. I don't know if you heard it on the Alex Jones radio show today before you came on. They were talking about the reporter, and his car allegedly caught fire, burst into flames, when he struck a tree. And I'm wondering what Mercedes has to say in retort of that. I'm pretty sure Mercedes isn't going to be happy with somebody saying that their car just burst into flames if it is to strike something.
Right. We're targeting lawful gun ownership in this country. We're not going after the criminals. Here in Texas, just like you said about accidents, you have over 1,000 fatalities here in the state of Texas this year
mm-hmm.
so far. 1,000 fatalities. Okay, on our Texas highways.
Right.
You ask them how many people have been killed by firearms. You're not going to come up with 1,000.
Right. And that's the thing, because we see all these groups. They're saying, "Well, we need this to protect the children. We need this to protect the children." I actually have this article right here. It says, 15-year-old son of deputy shoots burglary suspect. So this is a situation where a child, a child was left home alone. I believe he had a sister at home with him at the time. Somebody breaks into the house. The young man pulls out his father's AR-15, repeatedly shoots two suspects, hits them both. Lo and behold, some a kid actually knows how to aim, hits them both, drives them away. But then you have people saying this kid should have never been home alone with these weapons.
No, and Texas law allows for that. It's called Penal Code Section 46.13. There's a section in it that says that if your child gets access to your firearm to protect themselves or the family, then there's no prosecution for that. You know, it gives you a little way out. So, hey, you know, we look out for people, you know, that break into our homes and the kids are home and they get access to the firearm and use it responsibly to stop that threat.
Exactly. And speaking more on that, we have this Home Alone 12-year-old shoots intruder. Now, this is a young lady in Oklahoma. She is home alone. Somebody breaks into the house. She calls mom, mom, what do I do? Mom says, grab the gun, run to the closet. Young lady hides in the closet, hoping to be undetected. The gentleman or the intruder comes to the door, opens the door. It's wiggling the handle. She shoots through. Lo and behold, hits the guy.
And see, we talk about a plan all the time in class. You got to have a plan. You need to have a plan of what you're going to do to protect yourself and your family. I tell people, you know, if someone breaks into your house, what is your plan? What are you going to do? Where's that gun located? Is there around the chamber? Is it on safety? What are steps that have to take you to fire that gun? And so I actually try to get them to get a plan. If someone breaks into my home at 3 o'clock in the morning, I'm going to get all of my family members into a safe room. We have a code word. You have the alarm. If that code word is used, the alarm goes off. I want everyone to make it into the safe room. They make it into that safe room. In my safe room, I have a monitor where I can see my cameras 360 degrees around my house. Every entrance, every exit to my home has a camera. I can see as far left as the left side of my neighbor, as far right to the right side of my neighbor, every entrance, every exit to my home. They break into my home. My family members are accounted for. I'm not going to accidentally shoot one of my loved ones. I want to stop that threat. So it's about having a plan and protecting your family, because when it boils down to it, no one's going to protect you or your family. Police are not going to arrive in enough time.
Right. That's a very, very good point, because you get all these people, and even people who are responsible gun owners, the situation they run into. If somebody, lo and behold, breaks into my house, I don't want to accidentally shoot a family member. So I heard you talk about things such as code words and places to go. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that?
Right. I use a code word, like in my shop. We have a code word event. There's emergency inside the shop. We're doing a concealed handgun class of about 60 people one Saturday morning. And I had a class of 30-something odd number on one side and another class of about 25 and some odd number, total of 60 on another side of the building. And we're doing a concealed handgun class, and everyone was on break. They were, you know, in the restroom, shopping, or doing whatever outside, smoking a cigarette. And the guy came into the shop, and he wanted to buy a gun. Mm-hmm. He wanted to buy a gun to kill somebody. And he was shaking, and he had the cash to buy that gun. And he was going to buy that gun, and nothing was going to stop him from buying that gun. Mm-hmm. Well, my staff used the code word. And when they kicked that code word in, which, you know, never been used before, they used the code word. I said hi to the guy, and I identified what the issue was, and I hit the silent alarm. Mm-hmm. And then get the police rolled in that direction. And so I engaged that individual, start, gave him the paperwork, said, well, I'm going to help you buy that gun. You know, here's your paperwork, and you say you got the cash? All right, you have all the cash. You know, I want to help him buy that gun. And then police showed up. We got him outside. And when we got him outside, his girlfriend, some other people showed up. About 10 police officers showed up. There was a big fight outside in the parking lot, not in my shop.
Right.
You know, it's up to me to make sure I keep my employees safe, my customers safe, you know, and I want that to happen outside, not in my shop.
Have you heard anything about that since then? Have you followed up at all?
Yes, they actually took him to get a mental eval done.
Okay. All right. Well, see, that's a situation where a mental evaluation may be necessary, but we hear all these people saying, well, for somebody to purchase a firearm, we want them to have a mental health evaluation, but under the new Obamacare, it says that no interactions between you and your physician are private anymore. So let's say you're mad at, lo and behold, maybe the Spurs lose tonight. Right, right. I'm mad at the Spurs lost, so I'm going to go out and kill somebody. And then, oh, you're going to kill somebody, Mr. Smith? Well, let me report this, and then next time you go into, you know, the gun shop, you get flagged.
Right, exactly. And that's the one thing we're afraid of. Like our soldiers. Our soldiers are deployed overseas and in a hostile situation. They return back home, and they have some issues dealing with what, you know, took place overseas, actually shooting someone and those issues. Well, then they label them with PTSD. When they get back home, some people feel that, well, since they're labeled with PTSD, we should take their firearms away from them. Yeah. And then they'll turn around and redeploy them back into that war zone.
Exactly.
It's okay to have your firearm when you're overseas protecting someone else's constitutional rights or someone else's freedom. But when you're here in the United States, we're going to take yours away.
Yeah, and we see this. They've been demonizing veterans coming after the gun rights, you know, demonizing them in all the shows and so forth. But then again, you know, most veterans here, if they own a rifle, it's probably a semi-automatic, even though they're shooting fully automatics, flamethrowers, God knows what. over there overseas, but I don't want to focus just on that. Let's get back onto this. We get another document cam shot. Now, this is a situation, a group in Houston, I believe they've done this in other cities as well. Mm-hmm. They're giving out shotguns in high crime neighborhoods. And like I said, I believe they are doing this other places. Do you agree with this strategy?
I agree 100%. You know, we need to give the power back to the people, not go to the local police department and turn your guns in
right.
for $5 or whatever it is.
We'll get back to this Houston thing. But I want everybody to know, I've talked about this before, but I want everybody to know this. In states such as Arizona, mm-hmm. you know, state of Gabby Giffords, where Gabby Giffords got shot, when you turn in your gun to the police, they don't destroy it, they resell it. Which is to say, the gun that shot Gabby Giffords could be back out on the street today. Mm-hmm. Because they resell it. And they also do it in, I believe they do it in a suburb of Chicago. So you think about that next time you go to turn your guns and they give you a little dinky $25 gas card, they're going to resell your AK-47, your AR-15. Yeah, there you go, right there. Arizona law forces cities to resell guns from buyback programs. So there you go. Just keep that in mind.
So it's not really about safety, is it?
It's not about safety. It's about making money.
When it boils down to it, it's about making money.
Okay, I'm sorry. Now I interrupt. Now tell us about these shotguns in these high crime areas.
Yes, we need to empower, you know, the families to protect themselves. We need mm-hmm. to focus on families because law enforcement is just a phone call away. Yes, give the shotguns to the families so the families can protect themselves because the police are not going to arrive there in enough time. So I applaud this organization that's donating firearms to families and to the poor, the less fortunate. Because right. even our concealed handgun program that we have here in Texas, it costs money to take a class. You know, mm-hmm. you have to pay for the class and then get the license, mm-hmm. The fingerprinting done and all that stuff. So we've kind of gotten away from, you know, like Vermont, in the state of Vermont, where it's constitutional carry. Everyone can carry openly or concealed without a license. We've gotten away from that, and it's all about money now. Yes, I agree with that 100%. Constitutional carry, because everyone should have that right to protect themselves. You shouldn't have to go get special permission from Big Brother to, you know, to carry a handgun.
Right. All right, now, Mike, I want to get your opinion on this. We saw recently President Obama, he went down to Mexico, and he's standing there in front of a big crowd, and everybody's cheering him on. He says, the reason for gun violence in this country is because these guns came from the U.S., which is true. But they came, not all of them, but a good number of your more exotic guns, I guess you would say, came from the United States of America under Operation Fast and Furious that gave guns to Mexican drug cartels. Now, we hear all this rhetoric about background checks and stricter gun control, but we gave, under this administration, weapons to Mexican drug cartels. And the defense I always hear is, well, you know, we had Iran-Contra and we had these other things. And I'm not saying we didn't, but this administration gave weapons to Mexican drug cartels.
Right. Just like what the government is doing right now and focusing on giving arms to another country right now, they're going to let the same thing happen there that's happening in Mexico. We need to decriminalize marijuana and take that control away from the drug cartels. And then hold the administration accountable for what they're doing in selling arms or tracking arms or whatever they think they're doing, mm-hmm. because that's not helping the problem. They need to focus on their laws. They know when a gun's being purchased and, you know, they're tracking all that stuff, you know, and so they need to focus on, you know, on their side of the house and leave the people, the American people, out of it.
Mm. Now, I don't have an article for this, but it just popped in my head when we were discussing the topic of Mexicans, and this boils down to more Hispanics. But on the background checks for guns, I believe it changed in the past year where it has an additional box for people of Hispanic origin. Are you familiar with that?
Yes.
Okay, so when you saw that, what did you think about that?
Yeah, because they added a different box now. You have 10A, 10B,
yes.
Not Hispanic or Latino or Hispanic or Latino, mm-hmm. and then you pick 10B and say white, black, or Asian, or whatever. Right.
And the reason they say that's for is to track, you know, these, I guess, supposed guns going to Mexico or whatever Hispanic countries, gang violence, whatever.
We do something a little different in Texas since we actually border a foreign country. Mm-hmm. In Texas, if you purchase two handguns or two loan guns in a 5-day period, they've actually forced the gun store to fill out a form and report you to the FBI without your knowledge.
Right.
Okay. So because we're bordering Mexico. So that's one thing that, you know, I don't think people are aware of.
I'm glad you mentioned that. People know that now.
I'm against universal background checks because I don't think that we should focus on individuals and one person being able to sell a gun or a firearm to another private individual, mm-hmm. you know, that's one thing that we should do on the gun store side of the house. You know, we do background checks in the gun store. If a gun store goes to a gun show mm-hmm. to sell a gun in a gun show, they have to do a background check. The person has to fill out the form. We have to call the FBI and the NICS and do the background check in the gun show, gun store, as long as you're an FFL, a federal firearms license.
Right. So. Now, I want to go back to the debate briefly, then we'll get back to our articles when we saw you in the debate last week. Somebody brought up the point that, you know, he goes to a gun show and he sees all these licensed dealers selling thousands of guns and all that. And then you had a retort to that. What was your retort?
Well, the thing is, he said that, you know, he sees private individuals selling thousands of guns.
Okay.
And I said, well, if you see a private individual selling thousands of guns, I just want you to know that's a felony. That's illegal, and you need to report them to the ATF.
Can you explain to us why that is?
Because if you're selling firearms for profit, mm-hmm. then that's illegal according to the ATF. Okay? If you want to just sell your one particular gun or your five guns or whatever that you have in your stash, you can do that at the gun show. But when you get to the point where it's a business for you, then that becomes a felony.
Oh, okay. That makes sense. That makes sense to me. All right, now I want to go on to the racial views of guns, because we see so many people saying that guns are for white people, their guns are to oppress a specific race or class or whatever. We have this article from the LA Times. LA Times announces white men are terrorists. They're not jihadists. They are white, right-wing Americans, nearly all with an obsessive attachment to guns, who may represent a greater danger to the lives of American civilians than international terrorists.
Well, you know, in my family, you know, we're all, you know, black, mm-hmm. African American. I actually was raised by a retired minister, and he was 96. My great grandfather was 96 when he died. My great grandfather used to always have this Bible with him, and he would say to me, "Michael, I like to bring everyone the Lord." He always had that Bible. My great grandfather would open up that Bible. In the middle of that Bible, there was a hole cut out. He said, "Michael, I like to bring everyone the Lord." My great-grandfather would reach into that Bible, and he would take out a revolver, and he said that when I cannot bring them to the Lord, I will send them to the Lord. You know, so personal safety is for everyone. It's
right.
not just for whites, blacks, Asians, or whatever. It's for everyone. Everyone's concerned about that, and everyone's got guns. Certain people are more concerned about knowing the laws and, you know, and keeping themselves out of the system than mm-hmm. others. I said on the show earlier that, you know, we have over 1 million people that are locked up in this country, you know, getting to the race issue.
Mm-hmm.
1 million people locked up. Out of that million, majority of them are black, mm-hmm. are African American. So those are the ones that are going to be faced and having to deal with new laws, new gun control laws.
Exactly.
Because you're going to give tools to law enforcement to go after, put more blacks, lock them up in jail with these new gun laws. And so
I definitely agree with that, but I want people to know it's beyond a racial issue, because we see things like in Florida, a man was charged with 5 felonies for releasing balloons. I'm not sure if you saw that article or not. I'm dead serious. This guy, he was out, I believe he was getting a Valentine's gift for his sweetheart or whatever. You know, they're out. He says, "Hey, baby, I love you." And he releases some balloons. Cop pulls up. "Excuse me, sir. Did you just release those balloons?" Like, "Yeah, I'm just hanging out." Shack, take him to the paddy wagon. And now this guy got hit with 5 felonies.
Wow.
I'm not exactly sure, you know, what happened to him after that, but just the notion that you can be charged for something so simple, something so meaningless, is just another attempt to get everybody into the system.
Right, right. And I'm curious what the charge was on that.
It was, I don't know, maybe we can pull that up real quick.
And I tell you, a felony, you're talking, you get charged with a felony. That means you, according to the federal government, you cannot possess or own a firearm.
And that's the whole point. That's the exact point, because people think of felons, you know, your big-time drug pushers or your violent offenders, you know, people such as that. They don't think about somebody releasing balloons as a potential felon. We see people getting arrested for selling lemonade. I'm not necessarily saying that's a felony, but we've shown those videos. Just anything is a felony now.
Right.
I mean, just thinking outside the box is a felony. But that's okay. We won't belabor that point. I want to go back to this racial issue.
Mm-hmm.
I have this article right here. Danny Glover's claim versus the history of racism and gun control. Were you familiar with what Danny Glover said?
No.
This happened, I guess, back in February.
Okay.
And he said the Second Amendment was basically, is to protect slave owners. That was the history, the genesis of the Second Amendment, is to protect slave owners.
No, the original intent of the Second Amendment is so that the people can protect themselves from their government.
Exactly. And I mean, this was a mild internet meme at the time. I believe Ben Swan made an article about this. But basically, somebody was asking Danny Glover. I believe he was at a college giving a speech, and they say, "Hey, Danny Glover, what do you think about guns? You know, because I guess Sandy Hook had happened recently. And what do you think about guns?" He says, "You know, the gun laws in this country were to protect the slave owners." But then we think about some of the first gun laws in this country were just the opposite. They were imposed on freed slaves. And not just guns, but any type of weapon, swords, or whatever type of instruments that they had at the time.
Right, right, right. And I believe the original, when they actually started gun control, and it targeted, the black community with slaves and back in that time frame of, let's take the guns away from the slaves. That way the slaves can't protect themselves. Mm-hmm. And to me, I want to learn from the Jews. I definitely want to learn from the Jews, because if you remove my firearm, then you're going to, take my money, control me, and take my home, and everything else goes. Once you take that gun, everything else goes. And my motto is, when they come after my guns, I'm going to give them my bullets first.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. Now, I think we actually found that article about the balloons. I was making sure everybody knows I'm not making this up. Okay, so the guy was charged with, here it is, man faces 5 years in prison for releasing balloons on beach as a romantic gesture.
Wow.
Let's see, I see felony up there. I see the crime against the environment. That's what it was.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's real. Yeah, I think a couple of paragraphs above that, it talks about the felony. Yeah, according to the Sun Sentinel, let's see. It's an act of love, but a felony. So there you go. There you go. Just another attempt to get you in the system. Now, our time is coming short, but I want people to know that you're not just all about guns. You're about other activist issues as well. As a matter of fact, the first time I met you was down in San Antonio at a RFID student protest with Andrea Hernandez, a family we've documented on this show. And it had nothing to do with guns. You were just out there concerned. And tell us why you were there.
It's about life, liberty, and prosperity. It's about keeping government transparent and the people's business private. And government should not be tracking people. We should not be listening in on U.S. citizens. They need to be transparent, but our business needs to be private. What goes on at my home is my business. Stay out of my home, stay out of my bedroom, and leave my guns alone.
Yeah, I mean, when I'm at home on the toilet, I don't necessarily have anything to hide, but I don't think that's anybody's business. But we've come to the end, so can you give us your final thoughts?
Yeah, and like I said, my motto, and my name is Michael Cargill, owner of Central Texas Gunworks, and I like to remind people.
That's here in Austin.
Yes, here in Austin, Texas. Stay on target, stay on message. Life, liberty, and prosperity. And when they come knocking at your door to take your guns, then give them your bullets first.
There you go. Michael Cargill, Central Texas Gunworks. Thank you for your time, sir.
Thank you, sir.
All right. That's a good interview. And that was Michael Cargill. I definitely encourage you, if you are in the city of Austin or in Central Texas, go to CentralTexasGunworks.com. Also go to the physical location. There's a lot of great stuff there, not just guns, also concealed carry and so forth right there at Central Texas Gunworks. And also, if you'd like to support this broadcast, you can go to PrisonPlanet.tv. You can see the Alex Jones radio show, the nightly news, the special reports. All that is right there at PrisonPlanet.tv, including that weird Bilderberg thing. Oh, man, I can't get over that thing. I hate just looking at it. But don't go back to Marco. But also, you can go to the InfoWars shop and pick up some good Come and Take It shirts, because we had a lot of Second Amendment news today, so you can see them all right there. The AK-47, the AR-15, the one for the ladies, all of it is right there on the InfoWars store. So that's it for this edition of the InfoWars Nightly News. I'm your host, Jakari Jackson. We'll see you back tomorrow.
Now you can watch The Alex Jones Show live as it happens at InfoWars.com/show.
You'll find links to all of our content there and a free 15-day trial for Prison Planet TV.
More than 60 movies and documentaries all in one place at InfoWars.com/show.